Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name's Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, coach, trainer, and writer. My guests today are Alexandra Jameson and Bob Gower. Alex is a success coach for driven women. She has been featured on the Oprah Winfrey and Martha Stewart shows, was Elle Magazine's Inspirational Coach of 2015, and was the co-creator of the Oscar-nominated Supersize Me. Bob helps organizations design and build future-ready systems. He's an authority on lean, agile, and responsive organizational design, and has worked with Fjord, Spotify, GE, and many others. They're happily married and live in Brooklyn and have together written the book Radical Alignment, How to Have Game-Changing Conversations That Will Transform Your Business and Your Life. Alex, Bob, welcome to Power of 10.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So I'm married to a psychotherapist, psychoanalyst actually, and we have a lot of sort of dinner conversations, and most of my a lot of my work at the moment, especially during COVID, is coaching, design leadership coaching. So we have a lot of conversations about confidential and, you know, not swapping details conversations, but we have a lot of conversations about kind of themes that come up, and there's a lot of overlap. So how did this book come about? Because maybe each of you could tell a little bit about your background, but I am getting the sense that there might have been a kind of overlap in the kind of conversations you were having too.
Yes, I haven't thought about that in a while, but when we first got together about a decade ago, we kind of kept having those dinner conversations, and we're like, what you're talking about is what I'm talking about. And I was talking about it in a team context inside of organizations. So I was an agile coach at the time, and I was managing sort of helping design and manage big transformations, mostly at kind of Fortune 500 sort of companies. And then Alex was coaching individual women mostly. And then we were both just very, very interested in the science of habit change and sort of the psychology of sort of personal development and personal effectiveness. And it was like, oh, yeah, there was just so much overlap again and again and again.
Yeah. And that interestingly kind of led us to the seed of this book, which we actually led a couple of couples workshops. And it was an experiment because we realized we were using all these similar tools, and we had people in our personal lives who were coming to us for advice. So we offered a couple of workshops.
A couple of couples workshops.
and the thing that came out of those workshops was that generally, I'll be honest, it was like women dragging their man to the workshop and like, tell him how to do this better.
Fix him for me, please.
Right. And so they were coming with very different expectations and very different desire levels. And Bob had this great conversation tool to help everyone get on the same page.
Yeah.
And it grew into this now 4-step process that at the time we didn't even realize how valuable it was. But then after those workshops, we started using it in our work more and then in our relationship more. And then people from the workshops and all of our friends kept texting and calling, what was that 4-step thing you taught us again? And we were like, we should just put this in a Google Doc so we can stop explaining it to people. I'm like, wait a minute. After a few years of sharing this with people, we realized this is a thing that should be a book.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? The kind of self-alignment that happens, that often you're working on something and you realize that, you know, the actual work is the stuff around the sides and not the thing you thought was the work, and you have to kind of make that shift. It seems to happen a lot in conversations and professional work too, in relationships.
Yeah, I think for us, yeah, kind of a couple of things happened. One is that this was originally just a very small tool we used in order to get to what we thought was the real work of the workshop. You know, like, let's just get aligned first. Yeah. Now let's have the workshop. And then we suddenly realized that it was the most valuable part of the workshop for people, because that was the thing that people kept calling us about. And then the second thing, kind of a few years later, well, one, it had sort of creeped also into our life. We'd used it when we decided to get married. We'd used it to move. We'd used it when discussing career changes and child rearing and all sorts of things. And it'd become this kind of foundational tool that we've just revisited again and again ourselves. And then we were looking for, oh, maybe we should do something together. We had never really done any business together except for these workshops, which really didn't last. We're like, let's do something together. What should we do? And we had all these like wild ideas of things that we thought were valuable. And we're like, this thing is just sort of staring us in the face, that people just keep coming back to this thing that to us seems so self-evident and so simple. And I think really that's sometimes the, actually a friend of ours, Jonathan Fields, talks about product maker fit being as important as product market fit, you know, like, and that,
that's nice.
Right. And so there's this idea that this thing was sort of coming out of us naturally. And I think sometimes the things that come out of us naturally are really valuable to the world, but they're invisible to us because they sort of emerge from,
natural.
Yeah. They just seem natural. They seem self-evident to you. But they're not, but they're sort of, they can be transformational for the rest of the world. They don't seem self-evident to the rest of the world.
Yeah. And there's a journey that's this struggle, I think, between the sort of, I call it the struggle between sort of ego and humility, which I think you need both of, right? I think especially in I'm sure in your world too, actually, Alex, but in design, always feel designers have to have a bit of both, right? Because they need to sort of have enough ego to stand up for things that they believe in and kind of make stuff, but then enough humility to have the empathy and hear from other people and also to hear from the sort of business. But to have something like that, was that an issue, or was that something you had to sort of step into, if you like, or accept? Because I can imagine you've got this thing and you're saying, well, it's kind of self-evident to me. And I think a lot of people then feel, so what do I know, that the imposter syndrome kind of creeps in. Was that a difficult kind of hump for you to get over, or did you just help each other over it?
I tell you what helped, actually, was the fact that we shared it with a couple of friends that we really love and respect. And actually, my friend that wrote the foreword to the book became a huge cheerleader. She is a mother of five. She's an entrepreneur. Mm. Like, this has saved my marriage and changed how my family operates. And when there's someone you love and respect giving you such a strong signal, you like, ignore that at your own peril. It became,
right. Okay. So that you didn't feel like an imposter anymore.
No, we just keep getting messages and texts and from people who are like teachers who are using it in their middle school classrooms. Bob has tons of story from using it in boardroom meetings with lots of big egos in the room that he uses this method, and it totally changes the dynamic in a way that's just magical, honestly.
Yeah. So I have one more question about the sort of how the book came into being before we get onto the book, which is, you know, we just sort of talked about our respective marriages at the beginning. It co-authoring can be difficult at the kind of best of times, or challenging at least at the best of times. You know, you have different views on how exactly you want to say something. How much of that was going on, and how much of your, you know, presumably you're going to have to fully eat your own dog food, as they say, to go through the co-authoring process. How did you align on that?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it didn't go as badly as we thought it, as we feared it might. You know,
like it was really graceful.
Yeah, it actually, I think, you know, so the title of the book and the process that sits behind the book is called is Radical Alignment. And again, it's sort of the process that sits at the heart of it is this 4-part conversation that kind of helps you have all of the potentially missing conversations that people forget to have before they do something important together. Mm-hmm. And so we actually had to eat our own dog food or drink our own champagne or whatever the metaphor is. But, you know,
that one's better.
But we had to. So we actually had the conversation. We used this 4-part conversation before we ever even started on the project. And one of the the 4 parts are really simple. It's intentions, concerns, boundaries, and dreams. And you just kind of go through them. There's a lot of nuance to it once you get into various topics. But for the book, you know, like, well, why do you want to write a book? Well, you know, I want to, it's, books are good for your, you know, platform, for your career. It also seems to be a valuable tool. We'd like to get it out. We'd like to make a difference, make money, and, you know, improve our careers. Yeah. You know, it's pretty simple. But then the concerns is where all that stuff started coming up. So the concerns conversation is often the richest, and often where the crazy can show up and the potential landmines all show up. And for both of us, we actually had the identical landmine show up, and that, or the identical concern, which was, this is going to go so poorly that we're going to start hating each other, and we're going to get divorced, And then, of course, the way negativity bias works, we're going to die alone under a bridge. You know, like it's just sort of, you know, it's just, we just sort of shared that with each other. And then that, it kind of dissipated it, or I don't know.
Well, it really helped me to hear that you had the same fears. Yeah. And we had both, you know, we knew each other well enough to know these stories, but we've both had previous relationships and marriages where we attempted or succeeded at actual creative collaborations, but there was not clarity. There was not equal sharing. There was not equal credit. And I was like, I am not going down that road again. So like, let's get clear about how are we going to treat each other through this process? And it actually helped us get to the next step, which is boundaries. And one of our boundaries became so obvious. Well, okay, if we start fighting, like we don't write the book, like our marriage is more important than a book. Right. And we came up with another one, which was actually very freeing now that I look back. If one of us decides, you know what, I got to back out of this. It's just not good for me or for us. The other person has full permission to take it and create it if they choose to.
Right.
So it just felt so safe to go down this potentially dangerous path together. And we had very few points of friction.
And I think one other piece, which I've just kind of had forgotten about, but now I'm reminded again, is the writing process itself, is we were both very cautious at first. You know, like I would write a chapter or I'd be looking at something that she had written. Actually, that's more the use case here. Like I would be looking at something that she had written and be like, I should really talk to her about her intent behind this sentence and whether it's right or, you know, and I wanted to negotiate every single edit that I was going to make. And we realized like that's actually pretty slow and counter to what we're really trying to, counter to sort of, let's say boldness and creativity, you know, like really trying to write well, really trying, you know.
Yeah.
And so we developed another kind of guideline or rule or boundary for us, which was one, we're using Google Docs, so it's non-destructive editing. So you don't, you know, nothing is lost, right? You can go back to previous versions no matter what. And two, it was just like, just edit the heck out of me. You know, like you do, you know, like I'm going to edit the heck out of you. You edit the heck out of me. And we'll just kind of keep going through until we feel like something, we feel like we have something that we're both really happy with. And we just recorded the audio version of the book. So we got to read it again. And I was like, this is not my voice and it's not Alex's voice. It's an emergent, like it's a brand new voice.
Yeah.
And it's a voice that I prefer to my voice, you know, like, and I'm like, I really like this. And so I think it was a great lesson. I don't know if we'll do anything else together, but we may actually, but
it's so funny that you say that. We haven't talked about this at all. Yeah. I'm like, we did a really good job together writing together. Like this might be a thing that we do.
It's great when it happens, you know, it worked around Charles Eames. So, you know, you never know. It's interesting that I love being edited actually. And I know some people hate it, but I really like that. And particularly, you know, if you've got a good editor and you suddenly, oh yeah, that rambling sentence that I thought was so philosophical, you've turned into this really sort of concise thing. That's a really nice moments. Like you've kind of distilled that thought into something more pure and better. And also listening to you, one of the things that comes out is, you know, you're talking about using Google Docs and so forth is, of course, editing it's not like it's a kind of final thing. You can always change it back. And I think that there's a thing that happens often in conversations, the kind of panic that sets in when you're having a conversation about a thing that might be, but it's not yet sort of put into motion. And I think in the kind of fast paced sort of, you know, agile lean world, it's sort of like deliver, deliver, deliver. But, you know, there's a big journey from a sketch on a post-it note to something getting out on the market, but there's an awful lot of kind of panic that steps in. And as you were talking about the sort of beginning of process and doing that kind of deliberate catastrophizing, you know, in the kind of fears part of things or the concerns, the all-in method is what this is called, right?
Mm-hmm.
AIM. It's quite, I'm seeing the quote from Brené Brown is up kind of on, I've just got your book up here as well. It's quite kind of vulnerable thing for people to do. I can see in a couple's situation, you know, there's vulnerability that comes up. I can also see in a sort of work situation, a lot of people are used to putting on the kind of the armor of business. It's you know, it's not personal, it's business. How have you managed to create that space, that sort of safe space for people to actually go there with that?
Yeah, so I've learned through a lot of trial and error And both for myself too, you know, like it's actually hard for me to get up in front of a room full of business people, you know, like in boardrooms or and ask them to be vulnerable. And I've had to kind of overcome because I've seen so much value in it over the years that I've had to overcome my own sort of sense of decorum, I guess, right? And there are a couple of things I lean back on, and I'm sure it won't be unfamiliar to you and many of your listeners, but this idea of psychological safety or team psychological safety that Amy Edmondson talks about a lot. And that we don't really get to psychological safety unless we feel somewhat seen as a human being. And it's very challenging, I think, to be seen as a human being unless you're being somewhat vulnerable. So one of the things I'll say, I'll talk about team psychological safety. I'll also talk about some of Amy Cuddy's work on trust, the nature of trust being this dual assessment that the person cares about me and the person has the capability to deliver on what they promise. And that we really, our brains sort of unconsciously ask the care question first and the capability question second, because the cost of trusting somebody who doesn't care but has a lot of capability can be an existential threat. You know, we can think of some examples in politics right now. People have a lot of power but don't really seem to care about their constituents.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So that's when you say capability,
I mean power. Yeah. I mean, like they can deliver, they can do stuff, they can make stuff happen. So it could be intellectual capability, it could be skills, or it could be authority and power, right? A sense of institutional power.
Yeah.
And then the other side is care. But trusting somebody who cares, you know, like we've all had people on our team who care a lot and really work hard and they just don't have the skill, you know, like they're just maybe in the wrong position or they're early in their career. Trusting somebody like that doesn't really have a huge cost to it historically, evolutionarily, in terms of our sort of social development. And I see what happens a lot. And so I always bring this up and I say, look, you know, there's some really fun studies that I won't go into now, but really fun studies that kind of illustrate the point. I'll tell the story and I'll say, look, if you're going to lead with something, lead with care first, which means listening. It means paying attention. It means being curious, asking questions. We all know what care feels like and how it shows up. Okay. And then bring capability in second. If you try to prove yourself right first before you've proven that you care about somebody, you might actually be generating fear. So I'm sorry, that was kind of a long-winded way of saying, but I try to bring in data and I try to bring in, like, tell people why it's important. And then I frame the questions really, really carefully for the situation. So intentions, concerns, boundaries, and dreams are the buckets. But if I'm in a board meeting, like I was at a board meeting at a pretty big multinational nonprofit a few years ago, and I asked, you know, essentially, like, why are you a part of this board? Where does your values, you know, like, because your values brought you here. And what I had was people telling me stories. You know, people started telling stories of childhood. Actually, one person told a story of childhood abuse. And this was a nonprofit that was focused on climate change. And he just said, look, like, I didn't feel safe in my home growing up, but I felt safe in nature. And now, and this was like a guy who was like, not the easiest person to get along with, and the source of a lot of strife there. But we all immediately began to feel a sense of connection to him. And I think he set the tone. And I often encourage leaders to set the tone. And I often set the tone myself. If I'm leading and kicking things off, I'll be like, I'll tell a vulnerable story that sort of gives people permission.
So, you know, in that, there's funny, there's like a kind of cross-pollination going on, because in the sort of business world, in the workplace, you sort of have to bring in the human, right? And because there's an artificial separation there, as if, you know, I said the classic, it's business, it's not personal, it's business, but of course it's all personal. And yet, Alex, you know, in the couples and into the more sort of personal relationships, almost you're having to bring some structure back in. You know, almost make it more formal in order to kind of get through it's just a swamp of kind of messy human emotions. Is that a fair kind of summary? Or?
Absolutely. And I am like many of my very driven, successful coaching clients who, while they're very successful in the workplace, in their personal life or around personal topics, they feel overwhelmed by having important conversations because there is no structure.
Right.
And actually, and I, you know, it took me a year or two, and that's because I'm a little slow sometimes. It took me a little while to get really comfortable with having structured conversations around emotional topics. And now I'm the hugest advocate for it because I know where to put my feelings. I know how to organize my thoughts. And I know now that, oh, neither of us has to win here. This is an exchange of information so that we together can create something. It's not about me knowing the answers or defending against what you think is right. It's about us truly coming together. And that's like the beauty of the collaborative creative process. Like, let's bring our strengths and concerns together and create something even better than one of us could have made.
I was going to ask about that, actually, that sort of tension between having something structured and having something, not about spontaneous, but having some, yeah, maybe it's spontaneous, having something that's more loose. And so there's a cultural thing, and I don't know if it's more so in this, in sort of Anglo-Saxon world than, say, in Germany where I live now, but maybe we'll get onto the cultural thing. But there's a... there's this kind of feedback culture that has crept in kind of everywhere, sometimes not entirely healthily, you know, of, you know, if I could just give you a bit of feedback here, and then I'm going to say something insulting, you know, or, and then I'm going to just tell you what I think, that, you know, which isn't kind of really feedback. How much do you have to do with this kind of structure to stop it becoming kind of performative? Because it can become performative sometimes, that kind of structure thing, which is, you know, I'm going to play the role of a therapy, but I'm not really going to do it. Or I'm going to play the role of revealing myself as a leader, but it's a story I've told kind of 100 times before.
Man, absolutely. Well, there are some red flags, and we have some rules around this conversation that we go about in detail in the book. Mm. And the first one for me is, like, is this person coming to this conversation in good faith? Like, right. Do I believe that this person actually wants to connect with me about this topic? And a real easy, bright line to make that, like, am I doing this on Facebook? Probably, like, not going to get anywhere, right? And I've had interactions on Facebook very recently with important people in my life. I'm like, let's have a phone call about this topic, because this platform is not the place to have real, possibly transformative connections. And, you know, we've also told people, look, we can't fix your narcissist through this conversation, but we can help you get clear. I'm starting to call it aim yourself, like, use the all-in method for yourself to help you get clear before you approach someone, so that you feel a little bit more solid and self-correct before you decide to engage with somebody else.
It's a classic thing of the only thing you can change is yourself and your reactions. But when you do that, it shifts it in the other person, because you're not producing the same response that they're expecting to happen. I mean, it happens in families a lot, right? Because we all know how to press each other's buttons.
Yeah. And I think one thing we also do with the conversation when we're setting it up is that it is simply an exchange of information. So this isn't problem solving. So the promise is radical alignment. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the promise of this problem, you know, and that's a great outcome. And one very, very possible outcome that we're very clear about is, you know, so that's essentially a hell yes, you know, like, hey, yeah, we're aligned. We're great. This is perfect. But an equally good outcome is the hell no. It's like, oh yeah, this is not going to work. Either the way you're showing up doesn't work for me, or we kind of mutually figure out that we're so misaligned in terms of our intentions, like why we're doing something, or our different boundaries around, you know, like, we're going to go on vacation together and I must, you know, be in the jungle every day and you want to, you know, sip cocktails every day. Like, it's just not going to work. We should probably have separate vacations, right? So figuring out whether or not you're a hell yes or a hell no. And then the other thing is, we're very clear that, like, look, when you're sharing your boundaries, you're sharing your boundaries. And we frame them, you know, like, so in a work context, we might frame it as, what helps you be the best at work? You know, like, what helps you do the best work? So, and I always encourage people to think about things like, answering, what kind of boundaries do you put around answering email or answering communication? What kind, yeah. I have very strict boundaries for myself about scheduling meetings. I don't generally schedule meetings before noon because that's when I get my best writing work done and my yeah. best sort of cognitive work done. And so I just sort of, we're just sharing those with each other. And this is not a menu that you're creating, that you're ordering off of. You're not going to get necessarily everything you're asking for, and nor is anybody giving you orders when they're sharing their boundaries with you. What we're simply doing is sharing our information with each other, and we can negotiate later. What we want to do is get kind of everything out on the table, so we're negotiating from a kind of a complete space. And the reason we put dreams at the end is dreams have a way of bringing us back together and yeah. enrolling us in each other's sort of like vision for the future. But we already understand concerns, we already set boundaries, and we already set intentions. And so now we can have maybe a rich conversation about, okay, what kind of working agreements make sense for this project? What kind of schedule makes sense for this project? What kind of budget makes sense for this project? All of these things are now, we have really, really rich information to deal with.
And this project could be any, this is any kind of relationship, right?
Could be getting married. It could be. We find it very helpful to constrain the topic to a single topic with a reason that sits behind it. So, like, let's say personally, let's just go there. Let's just be pretty, vulnerable. We're going to talk about our sex life so that we can both feel satisfied and loved, right? Something right. like that. Hopefully that's not too outrageous for your audience.
It's fine.
And at work, we might say, we're going to talk about the next quarter so we can focus on the right things and so we can kind of, be the most effective team we can possibly be. Or we're forming a new team that's going after a very specific, product or a very specific, maybe it's a team that's focused on an internal project like organizational change, or it's focused on an external project like, a new product line or a new feature set for an existing product. Yeah. And we're going to talk about that so that we can get really clear and aligned on what we're going to do. And so we find just like constraining the topic keeps that kind of scope creep from coming in, where we all of a sudden are suddenly talking about, how your mother disappointed you or something, how did we get to this?
You talk about topic creep, you call it in the book, which I really liked because I think everyone's had one of those conversations. So I think you have... Well, you get scope creep at work, but you get kind of, I think, topic creep perhaps more in personal relationships where, you're discussing where you're going to go on holiday and all of a sudden you're having a kind of fight about the thing that you said to my mother, 5 years ago.
And that fear of topic creep keeps a lot of people from bringing up important topics because they're worried that it's going to get out of control and I just don't want to deal with a day-long fight.
Right. So I was going to ask about that because one of the things that I could imagine happening is, and you talked about it, it's not a negotiation, which is, but my dream hasn't been acknowledged or my fear hasn't been acknowledged. And I want to kind of bend this, this topic towards one of those two things. How do you kind of keep the rigor, I suppose, I'd say, in the process?
We actually recommend that you agree to a couple of ground rules as you enter into this format.
Right.
One is that people get equal speaking time and there's no crosstalk, right? You're not making little comments or even asking questions. Like we do offer, you can ask clarifying questions. Like if you don't understand what somebody yeah. said, you can ask a clarifying question. Don't ask a question that's really a veiled judgment. Right. What do you mean? Blah, blah, blah. Like, don't do that. Really, this is just you get 2 minutes to talk about your fears about this topic. Mm. I get 2 minutes to talk about my fears about this topic. You get 2 minutes about boundaries. I get 2 minutes. Like, just use, I promise you, it will be weird the first time you do it, but it will be revelatory in the way that you feel like, oh, I have to, like, I can just take a little space. I can even be quiet for 15 seconds as I think, and I'm not worried about somebody else like jumping in with their next comment.
Right. Yeah.
That sense of safety is actually really important.
So I've kind of jumped around a little bit in the book because you talked about the setting the stage where there's a lot of that up and then having the conversation. There's a, I don't know if you know the method, Stinky Fish. Do you know this method?
Never heard of it, but I love the name.
I think it comes from Hyper Island in Sweden. And then it's an expression, which is that the fish stinks from the head. Right? And so, but then I think that's a German one. But there's this thing that if you carry around a stinky fish, or there's a thing that you're kind of trying to hide, if you carry it around with you, it just stinks more and more and more. So the stinky fish conversation or activity is at the beginning of, you know, could be anything, could be like a, you know, leadership development, you know, workshop, it could be a project workshop, anything, where people lay their stinky fish on the table and kind of get that stuff out, going, I think this is going to be a load of kind of bullshit and it's never going to work or whatever it is, so that you do it at the beginning instead of kind of hanging on to it throughout the project. I've done this a few times, and one time it really, it kind of blew up, right? We were fortunate, kind of came up to lunch break, but it took up most of the morning of just people getting really kind of angry. And it was very, very hard to close it down. So can you talk about that bit? Because you talk about after the conversation, and, you know, in some ways it's sometimes easier to open up the can of worms than it is to kind of push them all back in, or not even push them back in, but to kind of, yeah, I don't know, settle the can of worms.
I think our all-in method has a very different energy to it than Stinky Fish. Because when you started talking about Stinky Fish, I'm like, that sounds like an invitation for people to bitch and complain. Yeah.
It can get like that if it's not properly managed.
When we're talking about our concerns, the question, we give tons of examples of questions to help you get clear about what your concerns are or how to frame it. It's like, you know, my concern is that I'll do a lot of work and not get any reward. Mm. My concern is that we won't sell as many units as we want to.
Yeah.
It's not like the stinky fish sounds like rehashing the past. And that is not, this is actually very different. And that is, intentionally very different.
We also frame it as, we point out, I think accurately, that humans have a very strong negativity bias, meaning, you know, our brains are naturally attuned to notice something. So, and the reason it comes after intentions is, as soon as I set an intention to doing something, most of us are going to think about how that thing is going to fail. Or, you know, like, that's really, and there's good evolutionary reasons for this, right? That we notice things that are wrong in our environment more than we notice things that are right in our environment. It's something our brains just naturally do. And many of the things, if not most of the things we notice, actually aren't, we don't actually need to fear them. They're actually inconsequential, because our brain is actually kind of flipping through this sort of list of things. Could this go wrong? Could this go wrong? Could this go wrong? Could this go wrong? And so that we invite people to be crazy. You know, we invite it. We like that just because you state a concern doesn't mean it's a real concern that you have that is actually going to come true. What you're doing is you're sharing with us what's going on inside of your brain that comes up as soon as you went at the start of the project. And I think that does two things. One is that it personalizes it. It makes that, like, if I share a concern, it's my concern. And then likewise, it requires a little bit of vulnerability, because I am sort of sharing things that I fear, you know, my own sort of fears. And we encourage people, you know, modulate yourself for the environment you're in, you know, allow yourself to feel safe, you know, but maybe take a risk as well and share something kind of that seems kind of silly that pops up in your head. And I think too, is it just sort of gets everything out on the table, and it doesn't, and it's because I think in Stinky Fish, I actually have run it a few times, so I'm not quite remembering it now, but we don't engage with the concern. We just listen to the concern that somebody brings up. We're like, oh, you have that concern. That's interesting. And then somebody will say, you know what? I got that concern too. That's crazy. It's a stupid concern, but I have it too. You know, and then it can actually sort of bring people together rather than pull them apart.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's a really testament to this idea of actually structuring this process and designing the kind of full arc of it, I suppose, rather than just sort of unleashing kind of hell. But you talk about, I mean, I'm talking, obviously, I guess most people listening to this, I mean, I'm making the force division here anyway, right? So I'm guessing most people listening to this, probably in sort of business and design in some way, because that's mostly what the podcast is about. But we're all human beings too. Then they'll all have these kind of issues. You talk about kind of, you know, parenting, you talk about, you know, love, sex, money. Do you think some of the relationships that you have at work mirror some of those kind of patterns that you have in your personal life?
You know, in the first few years of our relationship, Bob would tell me about just the dynamics in these high-powered executive boardrooms. Mm. And I was like, wow, it really feels like people are just reenacting their family systems from childhood.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, absolutely. And I see it with parents all the time. I see it with my own clients who are themselves leaders. And they see their own foibles and their own patterning show up. Like, oh my gosh, this thing that I grew up with, I'm now doing this with my employees, or I'm bringing my stuff from home into the workplace. And that is across genders.
Yeah.
Humans are emotional creatures of habit. So to think that somehow, because you have a certain title, that you are now a logical, rational person, I think is inaccurate. Anything else about that?
Well, you know, one of our favorite relationship therapists, we don't know him personally, but his books mm-hmm. have been really influential, is a guy named David Schnarch, and one of who wrote Passionate Marriage and a couple other books. Anyway, one of the things that he points out a lot is that we get into a personal relationship often because we think it's going to be a source of pleasure and fun and support, but we find out that actually all of our old family patterning comes up, and we think of that as like a bug, like mm-hmm. oh, if only we can eliminate that, we can get back to the love and the fun and the support. And he's like, that's actually kind of the wrong way to look at an intimate relationship. What we're actually trying to do is become better people. Yeah. And by being in the intimate relationship, it forces you to kind of up against your own sort of rough edges. And it becomes a sort of a people growing machine. It becomes a way of becoming a better person. And I think over the years, I've actually come to look at my business partnerships in very much the same way, that I come to a business partnership because I want to make something. I love product and I love creating stuff. It's also a place where I want maybe some partnership and I want to make some money, right? Like that's why I'm making a living and I'm trying mm-hmm. to make a difference. That's why I come to business. But the reality is that, and then I look at anything that gets in the way of that as a bug. You know, like my partner wants something differently than what I want, or something like that. And then I've realized, like, actually over the years that instead of looking at those as opportunities for, or those as things to be gotten rid of, they're actually things to be leaned into. And they're places where I get to become a better leader, a better partner, a better creative, a better person through the relationship and through the business problem. And I think that kind of inversion is something that I come back to again and again. And I really try to also share that with people as they're entering into this conversation. This conversation doesn't precede the work. This conversation in many ways is the work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, reading through it and kind of thinking about some of my wife's work, for example, but also, my work, I've been saying for ages that as you get more senior in the design world, sort of 99% of what you're doing is not this design problem's hard to crack. It's all just kind of people wrangling. And I was really kind of surprised how much of that, when I sort of realized that was what was going on, I just thought, no, hang on, it's just all people wrangling. Actually, the actual kind of doing bit is really easy. We just get in the way of ourselves all the time.
Part of the people you have to wrangle is yourself.
Well, the first one, right? I wanted to ask you something. I mean, Alex, you coach a lot of driven women, as you've put it in your bio. There's since your book's come out, we've had this whole kind of shift with Black Lives Matter. Plus, there's a lot of conversation about gender of the incomplete spectrum. Have you, I mean, talking about kind of patterns, have you sort of noticed anything that, shift in terms of, or get repeated in terms of kind of gender patterns? And, you've got these smart, strong, women, successful women at work, what kind of patterns do you see and what kind of things are coming up for them? And also, I guess, in racially too.
And then two quick stories. One is that I happen to be working with several women who are leaders in tech sales, like they're at the top of their sales team and it's all around tech. And there's a lot of focus now on inclusion and diversity and equity. And yet the women are kind of being invited to rise in the ranks, but then not really. And they're just really coming up against old structures.
Right.
Patriarchal structures that have been in place since the company was formed and founded. So there's a lot of, you know, people are making these big declarations for their companies right now,
yeah.
But internally, people in the system are not seeing those changes really lived out. So that's a huge frustration. Yeah. And I'm actually, you know, helping them get clear and make pitches and presentations using the all-in method to help them formulate their solutions.
Yeah.
But here's a story of hope that our own son, who's 13, we were talking about empathy and tactical empathy at the dinner table a couple weeks ago. And out of nowhere, he says, you know, I'm really glad I'm being raised learning how to care about other people's feelings.
Very nice.
So here's a 13-year-old boy who's a big-time skateboarder, and he's recognizing how important it is to listen and have empathy for. You don't have to agree with the yeah. person's feelings, but you have to understand how they feel and listen. So that gives me hope that change is possible. And it may take a while.
It is. I mean, it is encouraging, and it is hopeful. I think one of the kind of terrible situations that we're in is that we've shifted from, you know, I disagree with your, you know, point of view and your opinions and your philosophy. We won this time, you know, good luck next time, to, you know, you have to be destroyed. You know, for me to feel okay and comfortable of having won, you have to be destroyed. And it feels like, you know, hearing that story is a pretty good, a bit, some hope that that'll change.
And I think the way, so I work adjacent to diversity and inclusion consultants a lot, and I've worked adjacent to that space. And it's something that I care about quite a bit, you know, like the sort of a change in sort of, let's call it access to power, you know, I think access to leadership within organizations. And, you know, there's a lot of data out there that says that it's not the hiring pipeline that's the problem. It's the environment that people get into once they get hired, you know, like that you get a lot of attrition from people who kind of who come in. And the way I interpret it is that really the way power is thought about and wielded and structured in our society, whether it's financial power, political power, or sort of positional power in an organization, was designed by people who all shared a very similar identity and a very similar way of looking at the world. And so just to sort of say that we're going to change, you know, to have more women in power, that we're just going to put women in power and then they're going to behave the way men behaved in power, you know, like that's not really what we're actually trying to do is together. And I'd like to consider myself as like an ally and kind of part of the process, but like what we're trying to do is create new ways of running organizations, new ways of running teams that are much, much stronger, much more inclusive, much more inviting and naturally welcome much more diversity. It's not complete. It's not the only work that needs to be done, but I do think it's a key component of the work that needs to be done.
Yeah. It's classic in a way. When I kind of think about it now, hearing that, it, you know, in the context of our conversation, there's the perennial problem, you know, whether it's design and innovation, whether it's diversity and inclusion, whether it's, you know, rich, poor, divide, all of those things is what you were saying, Alex, which is you're inviting us kind of, or you're inviting that verbally, but you're not changing any of the structural stuff. And what I see in your approach, in your all-in method, is actually to bring the structural stuff right up front and say, let's kind of have a look at this structural stuff and let's put some structure around it and create some new rules, really, I guess, so that we can kind of continue to have that conversation. And it's not just going to snap back into its old patterns.
You know, the metaphor we use a lot is that this is playing scales, but we're all jazz musicians, right? So this is nice. So the methodology itself is not the be all and end all. What we're actually trying to do is install a new way of communication, a new way of thinking about communication, and you got to put the reps in, right? You know, great musicians play their scales, so great communicators should also play their scales.
That's a very good metaphor. I have an album somewhere of Charlie Parker's recording sessions, and there's a bit at the beginning where they happen to be recording and he's playing his scales quite badly at some points as well. And I think, oh, great. It was really good to hear Charlie Parker kind of try and play a lick and then screw it up and just keep going over and over and over. So it's encouraging.
That's what Coltrane would do, right? He would record himself, find out where he was bad, and then play where he was bad over and over and over again.
So listen, we're coming up to time. It's called Powers of 10, this podcast, because of the Eames film, kind of zooming in and out. And so the final question for our guests is, and I'll ask you both individually, what one small thing do you think has an outsized effect on the world and either is overlooked or should be redesigned or rethought?
We're looking at who's going to go first. I'll go first, so then you can take it home. For me, I think sort of the most powerful thing, and I'm going to again kind of take it back to identity a bit, right? So like, I'm a middle-aged white guy, and one of the and who was promoted to his level of incompetence many times in his career, you know, like, and found myself feeling like I needed to show up as the person who knew everything, and I didn't know everything. And what really has changed, and I think what really, for me, and what really is sort of the overlooked skill for people who are leading and looking to lead organizations, is listening and is sort of calming down, slowing down, especially when things seem counter to what I want or counter to what I think or are challenging ideas, to really deeply engage with them from a kind of humble, listening, really trying to understand space. You know, I mean, this is Stephen Covey, right? Seek first to understand before you or before you're understood, I think, isn't that Covey? Anyway, but yeah, try to understand, try to listen.
And I'll say that we need the people who haven't been listened to now be the leaders. And for the women that I work with specifically, learning to lead starts with learning to lead these important conversations in a way where everybody feels included and safe. And I have just seen, this is by far the best relationship I've had in my life. Mm-hmm. My business and our businesses are thriving. Our child is thriving. Like, I'm just seeing it in every area of my life wheel. And it's because finally in my 30s and 40s, I've learned how to address tough topics. And I really hope people take up this invitation to try it on themselves.
I hope they do too. That seems like a very good place to stop. Thank you so much. You can find Alexandra on alexandrajameson.com and Bob on bobgower.com. Where else can people find you on the interwebs?
Radicalalignmentbook.com. You can order the book, get a free chapter.
Very good.
You can even get a free course. It's coming out soon.
Yes.
So yeah. So if you order enough books, we'll invite you to a free course.
Well, okay. So yeah. So on radicalalignmentbook.com, you'll also find courses that you do, workshops that you do, as well as the book. And what about on any other toxic social media?
I love Instagram. I'm at Delicious Alex.
Okay, very nice.
And I'm Bob Gower on Instagram and LinkedIn. And I am not on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook.
Because you're smart.
I dabble in Reddit occasionally, but only a couple of subreddits.
Yes, I've got back into Reddit recently too. But for bonsai trees. It's helped to help me gain the long view of things. Alex, Bob, thank you so much for being my guests on Power of 10.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Thanks, Andy.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.